Welcome to the Corlin Economics Report, a weekly look at financial and political topics relating to asset-based investing. Guests on this program pay no fees to appear, and guests and hosts disclose any equity interest in companies profiled. Now, the Corlin Economics Report.
All right, welcome back. Continuing to listen to the weekend edition of the KE Report after those first two segments where we really just dissected and recapped all the data, all the news from this week on more of a macro front and central bank front. Now we're moving with focus into the resource sectors. We're chatting with Matt Geiger, managing partner at MJG Capital. We're going to be talking about some of the recent M&A in the resource sector and also getting a quick recap of how Matt's fund has done so far this year. And the big question a lot of our listeners are asking, when will the junior sector finally get moving and what are the catalysts for that? So Matt, let's talk about the MJG fund performance in at least the first half of 2024. We've talked a lot about how well metals prices have done, especially in the first half of the year, or even that second quarter. But let's talk more what the fund has experienced here. Matt, you broke down a lot of it in your investor letter sent in early July. Take us through how the fund did first half of this year.
Thanks for having me back on the program here, Corey. Yes, we put up the mid-year investor letter in early July. That can be read at the MJG Capital website at mjgcapital.com. I was pretty pleased with our performance in the first half of the year. We were up 14.5% through June month end. And as you know, it's been a really actually tough period for the juniors despite metal price increases that we've seen year to date. So performance was roughly quintuple that of the TSXV, at least over that period. And as you know, the MJG fund is very heavily weighted towards the junior end of the market. We have a $30 million median market cap, and only four of our 20 current positions have a market capitalization north of $100 million. So very much weighted to the junior end. So I think for folks that are following the mining industry closely, they'll be somewhat impressed by the performance over the period, probably less so for generalists as they watch the S&P 500 continue to truck higher. The S&P was up just 15% and change, so a little bit less than a percent more than the fund over the same period. And as mentioned, the first half of the year was characterized by metal price breakouts between the two bellwether metals, as I've described them, gold and copper. Gold was up roughly 15% through early July, copper close to 20% over that period. But the miners really writ large have failed to show any leverage to these metal price increases whatsoever. The big producers at best kept pace with metal in price increases, while the juniors, as mentioned in the first half of the year, were marginally positive. So over shorter time horizons, it's not super uncommon to see these dislocations between metal prices and the underlying miners. But at some point, this will have to be resolved, either through sharp pullbacks in the prices of these underlying metals, or with the miners playing catch up and the juniors included in that. And I mean, historically, mining equities will exhibit 2 to 3x price leverage to their underlying metals. That was certainly not the case in the first half of the year, but I've seen no evidence that over the longer run here that this relationship has broken. So I'm actually quite bullish, assuming metal prices stay put, if not move higher on where we sit, both with the miners generally and then also with the juniors more specifically.
Well, Matt, just to that point, as far as the mining stocks tracking the metals, they generally do, and there's generally that torque to the upside or the downside, depending on the direction of the metals. But we were just talking off mic that when you have an exploration company that's had drilling success or a development company that may have had a key resource update or economic report, they can actually move counter to their underlying commodity. You've mentioned on the show some of the positions you have that have done quite well, really in the spite of a lot of the other parts of the sector not moving. So maybe speak to how you've positioned in not really the metals, but really the projects and the people.
Well, that's right. I mean, in terms of our performance for the first half of the year, it was driven largely by four of our positions. So we'll say 20% of the portfolio. We had four names, each of which were up by over 50% year to date through the end of June. So it was certainly not a rising tide lifts all boats scenario by any means. It was a few specific positions who did very well due to company-specific catalysts. And as I've mentioned on this program before, the MJG investment philosophy is to invest in companies where even if metal prices stay flat indefinitely, there are company-specific catalysts, whether it's a drill program, whether it's a first economic study, whether it's success with permitting, whether it's M&A potentiality, where we can see gains, hopefully 2x or more in the current share price, even without metal price moves. So I'm far from an optionality investor. Obviously, if metal prices move in our direction, then that's wind in our sails. But by the same token, I look for opportunities that don't require the gold price to go up 20 or 30% or don't require $8 or $10 copper for these projects to make sense on paper. So that's something that I've stuck with really since the fund's inception. I think that's the smart way to go. There are some investors out there that are particularly attuned to the market cycles and can well time metal price moves. I do not fall into that bucket. I'm bullish on metal prices longer term here after 10 plus years of significant underinvestment in exploration development and in mine development. I'm assuming flat metal prices when I look at each of our investments, and would love to be surprised to the upside, but I'm not depending on that by any means.
Yeah, it's a good strategy, Matt. Plus, it provides maybe that extra kicker to the upside. But again, not all these stocks are taking part in this. This looks like a bull market for metals, and the breakouts we've seen in gold and even copper, you can argue, are very bull-focused. But why aren't these stocks all moving higher? Why aren't we seeing more investors come into the sector? What's the catalyst going to be for not just the juniors, but truly the juniors to get moving?
Well, the optimist in me sees the lack of reaction from the juniors as actually is actually good news and a harbinger of a longer duration in terms of this bull market. When you see the juniors react immediately to metal price moves, we might be looking at a shorter term move here in the space at large. But it, you know, one could argue, and we'll see looking back on 5 years from now whether this plays out. But this is largely how it's supposed to occur. The metal prices move first. Money trickles into the larger producers. The larger producers start to outperform metal prices, and then it's game on for the junior space. So I wouldn't rule out that this is playing out properly. I understand the frustration amongst junior-focused investors. I'm feeling the same. But we need to focus on longer-term time horizons to have success in this space. In terms of the potential catalyst to get the juniors moving here, I see a number of possibilities. I don't know exactly which one. One is just another upleg in metal prices, really stirring the animal spirits of speculators to come into the miners and then that trickling down to the juniors. And we may be seeing this with the gold price, actually, which I'd argue is the ultimate bellwether metal, with the gold hitting another all-time high just a couple weeks ago. And I think a break above 2,500, and it could be game on for the miners. So another leg higher in metal prices is one potentiality. A second would be metal prices that we've seen to date, with gold up 20%. Copper's seen a pretty significant pullback since late May, but it's still up double digits on the year. And it's possible we'll just need to see these higher metal prices reflecting in the earnings of the major miners for 1 to 2 quarters. And for generalists to realize that these companies are gushing cash and to wade back into the mining space after taking years off with most of the attention and affection, I should add, for a large cap tech at the moment. So that's another possibility. Another would be a world-class discovery to come out of the blue. This, of course, could happen at any time, and it could supercharge the whole space. Obviously, it didn't end well, but a prime example of this would be going back to Briex in the mid-90s. And that single quote-unquote discovery drove a 2 to 3 year bull market in juniors as people's senses of greed really came to the fore. And just on that note, the BBC just came out with a really good podcast, The $6 Billion Gold Scam. It was released originally in May, and I think the final episode has just come out. So even for those well-versed with the Briex story, that I found that to be a fascinating listen. Would highly recommend it. And then I'd say the final potential catalyst, and probably the most likely at this point, is increased deal-making activity. Obviously, just yesterday, we had a huge M&A deal with the Filo takeover by BHP and Lundin Mining. And then that also overshadowed a deal between Integra and Florida Canyon Gold. And just a couple of weeks back, we also saw Agnico Eagle put a large chunk of change into 4N Mining, followed shortly thereafter by Zijin Mining, making a large strategic investment in Montage Gold. So even though the summer doldrums are in full swing and it's been, you know, slow on the news flow front for a lot of these companies, I would argue it's actually been very busy on the M&A front. So I'd say increased M&A is probably the best bet for the catalyst that will shake the juniors out of their doldrums. But honestly, from an MJG fund perspective, we're investing over long enough timelines where I really don't care which of these potential catalysts, you know, actually manifests. And I feel that it's coming for the junior space, absent a larger breakdown in the broader market. which is kind of the one potential thing that could throw cold water on the space in the near term.
Well, Matt, out of those four catalysts you laid out, which were great, by the way, let's dig in a little bit further to the M&A. Let's pull on that string for a second, because really the year has gotten off to a pretty big start. I mean, we were tracking, I think, over 14 M&A deals in the sector just by the summertime, by June and July. So it has been active, and that gets money circulating in the sector. So as people are in a position where that's taken over, they then take that money and rotate it into new names. Do you think that kind of energy of the money circulation and rotation is what we need to see more in the space? And are we going to see more of the juniors taken out now? Because we have seen some bigger deals amongst some of the larger players, but when do they actually move down into the true juniors?
Well, I think that's right. I mean, I think a big sale, like we saw with Philo just yesterday, can be psychologically energizing for participants in the space, because a whole lot can go wrong. And many of us have experienced that. But occasionally we do see these rags to riches stories, and Philo certainly one of them, with share price going up close to 20x from when the initial discovery was made to now this exit likely to be at $33 Canadian per share. And in terms of the Philo deal, I mean, we're talking $2.8 billion in cash finding its way into the hands of Philo shareholders. And this is really a massive liquidity event for many of the key players in the mining space more generally. Again, this cash transfer won't happen overnight. We're talking about the deal closing in Q1 2025. But over the next 6 or 9 months, we're going to see significant liquidity come into the hands of some big investors in the space. And really, if only half of this cash consideration is redeployed into mining equities, we're talking about a wall of money, really, $1.5 billion to be deployed over the next 6 to 9 months. And it's likely that a good chunk of this will go into exploration and development stage names, which is exactly the stage that Philo was at. So I don't think one can underestimate the potential significance of this deal for the junior mining space at large. But I also don't think we should expect each of our holdings to be up 10% overnight.
Yeah, fair enough. Be reasonable about it. But let's talk about that Philo takeover. BHP, Lundin Mining, combining here to form a JV. They're going to have Philo del Sol and the Jose Maria property, both in the Vicuña District in Argentina. This is still going to take a while for these projects to develop, but these are massive projects with two companies that have money to back them. What do you think it means for the Vicuña District in Argentina? Are there other opportunities there? And what do you think about the potential of these two companies moving these into production? What's a time frame?
Well, there's a lot going on here. And so I'll try to share a couple points that maybe hasn't been shared already by many of the market commentators. I mean, this is obviously one of the biggest deals of the year for the mining space. The first, just taking a step back, this is a good reminder that a metals project needs two things to work in its favor: grade and tonnage. Grade and tonnage, grade and tonnage. Many projects have one or not the other, and many more have neither a greater tonnage to be an economic mineral deposit. Philo del Sol obviously has both of these. And to a degree that, despite many hairs on the project, it's extremely remote with very little infrastructure to speak of in the region. There's an acute lack of water, which is going to be a clear focus as the company develops this asset over the coming 10 years. The deposit straddling a border between Chile and Argentina, with good chunks of the deposit sitting on either side. So that's not going to be easy from a permitting perspective. Perhaps most importantly, there's high levels of arsenic spread pretty uniformly throughout the mineralization there. So there are actually a lot of hairs on this project. This is not going to be easy to develop by any means. But the size, the immense size and the grade clearly won out at the end of the day. And it was compelling enough for BHP and Lundin to make an offer. And the price tag here, this makes this one of the most expensive purchases of a pre-production mining asset in this industry's history. So grade and tonnage won out at the end of the day, despite some clear hairs on the project. Second point here, in terms of the final takeover price, I know some Philo shareholders are going to be disappointed with the final sales price here, which is at a roughly 12% premium to the closing price yesterday, a 17% premium to the day that the takeover rumors were first announced. I believe this was on July 12th, and a 32% premium to the day before the takeover rumors first circulated in the press. I know there are some Filo shareholders out there that were hoping for up to $40 per share and a 2% royalty to be spun out before any potential transaction took place. That's clearly not the case here. They'll be getting $33 a share and no royalty. But, you know, stepping back, I think Filo management, led by Jamie Beck, obviously with close oversight by the Lundins, I think they made the right decision here to take the money and run. And I say this for a couple reasons. The first is that the project stage had already passed the initial speculative run-up phase that you'll see in the Lassonde curve. And it was starting to inch into the trough, that trough of despair, as a project can take many years, and especially given the size and remoteness of this project. We're talking 6, 7, 8, 10 years of permitting, infill drilling, detailed engineering work. Like the sexy phase of the mineral discovery has passed. And so I think management recognized that and decided now was as good of a time to exit as any. And I think the second point here is just due to the scale of the project, both the size and the initial CapEx it will cost to build and the market capitalization of Filo itself, there are really only a handful of potential suitors for this project. You could count them on one hand. And really since BHP, you know, stepped into the fray in the spring of 2022 with their, you know, 5% strategic investment, they were always going to be the group. If any group took it over, they were always going to be the group that made the move. So it seems like the talk of the royalty spin out really forced BHP's hand with Lundin Mining coming along for the ride. And I think that's why we saw the deal occur at this point.
Well, Matt, when you think about the size of copper projects and how much capital is needed and how much experience is needed to bring those mines on, like you say, there's not a lot of suitors for a lot of these companies, but this was creative in that you have two companies working together. It reminds me a lot of Agnico Eagle and Yamana taking on Malartic for a gold operation, or it reminds me of Barrick and Newmont working together as Nevada Gold Mines. Do we need to see more collaboration between companies where they form JVs to do it together? Because the scuttlebutt is always which company is going to take it over. But clearly, it could be two companies working in tandem.
I think you're dead on. And we may have discussed this on a previous podcast here. But yeah, this is a trend that we'll continue to see. These projects are incredibly capital intensive, highly risky, both technically and in terms of the potential for cost overruns. And even the world's largest miner in BHP, I think will be happy going forward to partner with like-minded groups to push projects of this scale further. I mean, BHP are going to be committing a huge amount of their technical resources to this project. So not only are you seeing companies partner with other groups to push projects forward, but they can probably only commit their resources to one or two of these projects at a time, which is why longer term, I'm very bullish on copper in particular, because even a project of this scale is not going to make a huge dent in global copper supply. It's just too big of a market already. And so you have the big boys already strained internally for technical resources, being able to dedicate the time and money to one and maybe two of these projects at any given time. And then even from the point where you press go, let alone the years that it can take in terms of engineering and permitting and pre-construction activities to get to that point, we're talking 4 or 5 years if the project's executed properly for us to actually get to nameplate production. So there's going to be a huge lag between copper. I would argue the copper price, the incentive price for copper is around $5.50 or $6 per pound. And we could see double that. We could see the big boys get a move on pushing these projects forward. And there's still going to be a multi-year lag, 3, 4, 5 years before we see any meaningful supply come online. So I think that needs to be hammered home. These are not medium-sized gold deposits that, if all goes to plan, can be put into production in 12 months or 18 months. This is a Herculean effort. And I think it speaks to BHP's willingness to work with another partner here rather than try to take it on its own.
Hey, it's just smart business, I think, with big companies with money teaming up just so they don't have all that risk on them. But Matt, what's an investment opportunity on the back of this? Vicuña District, Argentina broadly, does this bring in more interest there? Or other Lundin companies, the ones that are maybe smaller, they're still working, they're still exploring any investment opportunities on either of those fronts?
Well, you know, speculative interests come into NGEN, which is another Lundin-affiliated company, and likely into Mirasol as well, which probably amongst the juniors has the best-looking ground in this district. But I would urge, between Jose Maria, I mean, it looks like these two operations are going to be integrated. And so we'll see first production at Jose Maria, maybe at best in 2029. And that's very aggressive, followed many years later by production from Filo del Sol itself. Between those two deposits, there's decades of mine life already. So I'd be a little cautious rushing into the nearby area plays. Maybe there is consolidation and maybe it happens more quickly. But I think between the resources of Jose Maria and Filo del Sol, BHP and Lundin Mining have plenty to work with for the time being. More broadly, we'll see if there's a rush into copper developers more broadly, as MJG has significant exposure to copper-focused names with, as of June month end, 36% of our portfolio weighted towards copper. I'd like to think that there'll be a speculative fervor in the aftermath of this deal, but that remains to be seen. I mean, deals of this size in particular take a lot of time to come together. And I do think this could be the starting gun on a bit of an M&A spree, but it doesn't mean we'll see anything next week or next month. This certainly sets the pace, and there are definitely more copper acquisitions to come.
Well, just one more wrinkle in this Chilean belt where there's water are such a concern. I just saw an article out a week or two ago, Matt, where it was talking about the energy prices to produce copper going from 4% to 44% over the next 10 years. So in a decade, they're almost expecting a 10x rise. And I think it's a 3x rise in energy just in the next 3 years. So part of that is desalination plants and all the energy that is needed to take salt water, convert it to water that can be used at mine site and pipe it over there. That is what Lundin Mining is doing at a couple of their projects. Do you think that's a trend that we need to shine a light on, that to get copper out for the energy transition, there's a lot of energy you need just to get the copper out, not to mention all the trucks and all the diesel, but the water issue you brought up is a huge thing for Chile, and it's big in Argentina as well. What do you make of the energy consumption needed to even make these projects happen?
Yeah, that's a key point. I mean, you mentioned the desalinization angle, that's especially in Chile, that's going to be a huge consumer of energy. I guess the second variable that supports the point, you're seeing a lot of these companies move to renewable sources to the degree that they can. And that's more expensive energy to produce. These companies are looking towards a future where you'll receive a premium or at the very least receive social and permitting approval to operate these mines due to renewable sources. But it's much cheaper to power a mine off of a coal or gas powered plant. And that's going to remain the case. So that's a second variable there. A third is just look at the overall grade, the head grades of these deposits. I mean, going back 30 years, the average head grade was close to 2% copper for your average copper mine. We're down to 0.5% and going lower. So you have to move four times the amount of dirt that you did 30 years ago to get the same amount of copper out of the ground. That's another variable. And yeah, then I would just argue more broadly that we're going to see electricity prices rise over time here. So that's another broader factor that I think will affect this. So that's an important trend that we're seeing. Labor is the most important cost factor for most of these projects, though we are starting to see operations mechanized and automated. BHP actually just announced that their Spence project in Chile is now entirely run by autonomous vehicles, which is interesting. And that may throw a wrinkle into the labor negotiations that are ongoing right now between the unions at Escondida and BHP itself, just mentioning, look, we fully automated one of our operations. So that's a point of leverage that we have. But yeah, labor and electricity are the two main cost inputs that investors should keep an eye on. And I would argue certainly on the electricity front and on the labor front for the foreseeable future. I mean, it's a bit of a battle between rising wages and then the deflationary force of automation. So it's a little less clear to me how that will play out. But those are the two cost inputs that investors should keep their attention on.
Yeah, that's a good point on the automation front. But fact of the matter is, look, costs keep going up. Metals prices need to keep going up too. And these things need to get built. So hopefully we will continue to see some successful mine builds, not just in copper, but in a wide range of these other metal sectors. Matt, on to kind of the market aspect of things. When you're looking at the MJG portfolio, when you're looking around the resource sector, where are you seeing some of the best investment opportunities in metals and certain stages of companies within those metals?
Well, I would say from a pure contrarian perspective, on the metals front, I mean, PGMs, nickel, zinc, vanadium, And now probably even lithium, which has had a stunning fall from grace as recently as early 2023, with lithium spot prices off close to 85% over that period. So just wild drawdown in lithium prices. I would say those are probably the most unloved metals at the moment. We're also seeing, it's not nearly as contrarian, but we're also seeing a breather in uranium-focused names. So there's potentially an opportunity there. And uranium is a space that we've had very little exposure to within the MJG portfolio since we sold a pretty chunky position in Global Atomic in mid-2022. So there may be an opportunity to re-up some uranium exposure within the portfolio. In terms of PGMs and nickel, we already have significant exposure to those two metals through Bravo Mining, which is our largest holding by quite a healthy margin within the portfolio. So, but yeah, I'm definitely positively inclined towards zinc, vanadium, and lithium, with the understanding that the metal of focus holds very little weighting within the MJG investment process when compared to the people, the asset quality, the company structure, its valuation, and other company-specific factors. So I want to make that point clear. In terms of stage, the MJG portfolio is already very heavily weighted towards exploration stage names, whether through explorers themselves or companies operating under the prospect generation business model. And as of mid-year, we were at just under 50% exposure to exploration and PGs. So I will say that the companies that are on our watch list, the four companies that I'm most likely to initiate a position in here in the coming months, three of them are later stage developers, and one of them is actually a producer, which is pretty rare within the MJG portfolio. So I'm looking to diversify a little bit in terms of business model and maybe move a little bit more towards the developed names, understanding that we already have very healthy exposure to the explorers and PGs, and we'll keep it that way. But as always, I'd advise listeners to focus on quality, well-incentivized teams that they trust and really and stick with them. And try not to get too cute with the commodity of focus or the stage of the company. I think these are our factors to consider, but they shouldn't be the key determinant in any investment decision. So I'll end on that point.
Well, Matt, one more point that maybe tying those different to get those different ideas together is to get commodity exposure. Another way you've utilized in your fund is through royalty companies, where you have exposure to many of those metals you named without the individual company risk. So maybe just speak to your thoughts on positioning in royalty companies to gain exposure as well as individual mining stocks.
Well, that's right. I mean, the vast majority of our portfolio, close to 75-80% of our portfolio, are pre-revenue names. So they're either exploring or developing mineral deposits. In terms of our cash flowing names, we much prefer the royalty business model. So that's close to 20% of the portfolio. And if you look at the MJG investor letter, you'll see updates on a few of those royalty names that I've talked about and written about publicly, including Altius Minerals and Elemental Altus. I think if you're investing over long time periods, investing in the royalty names is the way to go, with the understanding when we do get to the later stages of a metals bull market, that the miners will outperform the royalty names. But given that we have so much relative risk amongst our exploration and development stage names, I'm quite comfortable to have the royalty names filling a 20 or 30% gap within the portfolio to provide a little bit more stability to our returns. So very much focused on the royalty business model. We do have one producing name within the portfolio, and there's the potential for a second one to maybe enter the fray here in the coming months, but certainly will remain more heavily weighted towards the royalty business model than we ever will to producing miners.
All right. Very interesting, though. You are looking at diversifying a little bit towards some of those later stage developers, even maybe a miner. I find that very interesting, Matt. And I always appreciate you sharing your insights and what's happening with the MJG portfolio. Look, there are only so many funds that are focused on this sector. So getting the insights of these sector-specific funds, I think it's very important for investors to understand where some of the larger pools of capital go. And hey, just like that Filo deal, we continue to see companies needing to be backed by large money that can support projects, that can support them even in downtimes and fund exploration, and then create deals, even partnerships with even larger companies. Everyone, that's the end of our show. I hope you all enjoyed this weekend's edition. Please be sure to go back through our website, podcast, and YouTube channel to listen to all our daily editorials covering market moves and company updates. Matt, thank you for your time. Everyone, thanks for tuning in. I hope you all have a great rest of your weekend.
Al Corlin's firm, A.B. Corlin & Associates Incorporated, provides consulting services to public companies on matters of regulatory compliance. To find out more, follow the link from www.kereport.com. The Corlin Economics Report will be back after this brief timeout.